A very quick introduction to my friend Sid. Sid is one of Canada's like most sought after youth communicators. We've been traveling back and forth for years. We never met each other, and we'd always be on the same like speaker lineup on a conference, but we'd come in on different days and never see each other. Eventually, we finally said, "Hey, we've actually just got to meet and chat." And that was at CYWC at the Hyatt Vancouver, the first time we met, and we finally sat down and chat. And he's got a good resume, as it were, and he's very qualified to be doing this talk and to be serving. He's got kids, but he's not going to pretend to be an expert. I love that, but he really is in a lot of ways. He's done the research and has done the study. But what I like most about Sid is that he's kind and he's a sincere friend of the local church. Mm. He's a champion of the local church and he's a champion of holistic youth ministry. Mm. And so bringing in Sid tonight, he's done the research on the topic, but is also a person that I wanted to come close to our family and our extended family, because he's something I just really love the way he ministers, and there's a humility to it. And anyways, I just love you, bro. I really appreciate you making the time. He was in town doing a youth workers training conference at Peaceport Alliance Church. There's how many youth workers were there?
350.
I was lowballing it, which is rare for Pentecostals.
No,
usually we go really high.
I went high because I wanted to be like, part of the community.
It was five, six hundy, maybe a thou.
It was awesome.
Just an even thou. Anyways, he was in town teaching yesterday and Friday, and then he stayed over another night just to do this, which is amazing. And he met with us this afternoon and did some coaching with our youth team. Just incredibly valuable afternoon.
Yeah.
And so I just want to start by praying and just thanking you, man, for making time. Okay. And there's going to be time for Q&A afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. And throughout.
Cool. Yeah. Sweet. So if you're desperate, throw up your hand, but we'll make sure there's time for Q&A afterwards. Let me pray.
Yeah.
God, thank you so much for this time together. We're thankful for Sid. God bless Sid. God, I pray somehow he would go home even more full of energy than when he left.
Awesome.
God, I pray that you'd lead this conversation tonight.
Yeah.
God, I feel in my own heart a measure of anxiety around this topic.
Hmm.
And so just as we approach something that might make some of us anxious, God, the data's in that our cell phones are making our kids anxious. God, I pray that your spirit would be here ministering peace to our hearts. Mm-hmm. God, we're not afraid. God, because you're in control.
Yeah.
So God, you lead this conversation with the wisdom that Sid can bring from the wisdom of the research that he's done. But God, even just your spirit at work in our hearts, God, we just invite you into this conversation. And God, I pray that we would encounter you more than we expected on a Sunday night in a seminar like this.
Yeah.
In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen.
And some people said?
Amen.
So many of them said it.
So many of them.
So many. That's so good.
So my background is Mennonite roots. I got to tell you, we never get that kind of amen. This is fantastic. You know, just a quick little story in terms of, like, I loved it when you were talking about inviting us in as leaders in our youth ministry. So I for 11 years oversaw the student ministry at the E Free Church in Lethbridge, Alberta. And our lead pastor's name was Ian Lawson. And at this point in time, he was like into his 50s. He was an administrator. That was really his gifts, were in administration. He'd been one of the VPs at Briarcrest when I went to school there. And we just changed the leadership structure in our church a bit, so we had this extra time. And so in the summer before he came to me, a young boy in grade 9 had come to the church. He'd actually heard Ian speaking online, and they walked to the church. He had to walk quite a ways and sat in a service and then waited outside for Ian to come to him, and Ian actually got to lead him to faith in Christ, right? So it was really awesome. His name is Jean-Paul. So anyways, in fast track to here, we changed the structure of our ministry, and so Ian comes to me one day and he goes, "Hey, Sid," he goes, "I think maybe I'd like to volunteer in the youth ministry." He had never done this before in his whole entire life. And so I just kind of assumed that maybe he was really tired, or you know something wasn't quite working for him in that moment, and he wasn't thinking clearly. So I immediately got him to sign a contract with us so that we could just lock that down, right? So we got him. And then he became very nervous in the weeks leading up to the kickoff of our ministry, and he finally came to go, "Sid, what do I got to do? And I just said, "Ian, you're good. All you have to do is just show up and just be present. And enjoy the kids. Like, that's okay. It's going to be fantastic." And we made him, he was going to be the small group leader of our grade 9 boys with a younger individual. You know what I mean? So Ian could just be Ian and the younger guy could be all over the place. And just bring his wisdom and his experience. He had five children that he'd raised, of course, he and Connie. Just wonderful. And so I remember as we got to the day of kickoff. And so now he was trying to kind of pull out, but I'm like, "You signed, and you're a lead pastor, and I will tell stories of your lack of integrity if you pull out, like all of them." So his daughter told me he went home that evening, and was trying on these hoodies that he found in front of the mirror and ball caps. And she came in and goes, "Dad, what are you doing?" And he goes, "Well, I got to kind of look the part." She goes, "Dad, you never wear a hoodie. Stop wearing hoodies." So he went back to his collared shirt. That was great. And I remember just thinking to myself, you know what? I think it would be a win if we could make it through tonight with Ian and we don't kill him. Like, I think that would be actually a great win for us. And it turns out we actually almost killed him. So literally, what happened was, this is his very first night of youth ministry ever. Remember, this is Southern Alberta. So let me just kind of set the stage for you. And that night, we were registering our students. And part of our night was a wagon ride, hay wagon ride. So we created this wagon, attached it to a truck, put bales on it, and then I'd gone to my youth pastors and I said, "Hey, you guys, safety first, let's build a rail." So they're like, "Okay." So they quickly built a rail. So Ian shows up, we have a hay ride in our parking lot, it's about yay high, railing on top. And I remember Jean-Paul was there, so Ian was excited to see Jean-Paul again. And Jean-Paul's sitting on the railing, and so Ian gets up on the hay rack, and he sits down on the railing beside Jean-Paul, and suddenly the railing begins to break, and literally, he's on top of this trailer on a rail. He literally falls back off this breaking rail and does a backflip and lands on his stomach on the parking lot. Boom! And I'm like, "We killed him. Like, this is the end." And then all of a sudden, he kind of jumps up, and I'm like, "He just got healed." You know, that's not normal in an E-free church. I'll be honest. It's normal for you, not so much us. And so then as he jumps up, Jean-Paul is hanging off the rail about to fall, and he grabs Jean-Paul, saves him for the second time. It was awesome, right? And so that was the beginning of his youth ministry journey with us for 4 years. It was wonderful. It was really interesting. I think we kind of maybe wrecked his small group's perspective in terms of how lead pastors function in their church environments, because that first year we do a kickoff retreat at our church, and he slept on the floor in a classroom with his grade 9 boys Friday to Saturday and then preached 3 times on Sunday. And I just thought, oh boy, if these guys grow up thinking this is how our senior pastor rolls, I'm not sure, they may be disappointed. So that was a wonderful journey, and his ministry was powerful for us. And it just reminded me again, we need our wisdom. You know, like our kids need wisdom so badly right now. They have more information coming at them than at any other point in history ever. And maybe less discernment than what we've seen. You know what I mean? And so the need to have those who have lived and experienced life and experienced Christ working in life is just unfathomably valuable as they come alongside, and not just our students, but come alongside some of our other younger leaders as well, right? So just a wonderful opportunity. I'd really affirm that. It's interesting when it comes to doing parenting seminars. If I'm really honest, I think I probably had much better seminars before I was actually the parent of an adolescent. You know what I mean? I had this really great formula that I knew would fix most problems, period. And then when I became a parent, I realized my formulas didn't work, and my seminars kind of just became like group therapy sessions, to be honest with you. That was kind of the journey. We have a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I was reflecting on my experience that I had with them just the other night. So we'd come back from a basketball tournament. It was quite late at night. Cole, my youngest child, had brought 5 of his buddies from the basketball team to stay overnight. And so they got in. So one of the first things that we do before they go to bed is we collect all their cell phones, right? Because we want to be, you know, we're really aware of what they might be bringing on their phone into our environment, especially when they're away from some of their environments. And so we're cautious about that. And our values are in our home may be different than the values of their home. And I remember thinking about that, like collecting their cell phones and guarding that. Like, that was never an issue for me growing up, right? Like, so I grew up in a really small town called Elkhorn, Manitoba. We never had to worry about someone taking their phone somewhere because you could never get farther than like 2 feet from your wall, correct? Right? Like, it was attached. Now, really cool homes bought the extension cord, and so then you could get like 10 feet, which meant you could go into another room and close the door to get some privacy, which we thought was really awesome until someone else picked up one of the other phones in the house and they could listen to you. So your privacy was gone. And in fact, where I grew up, it wasn't just that you lost your privacy in your home. You lost your privacy in, like, your whole neighborhood. So we lived in the country, and everyone within, like, 4 or 5 miles could also pick up their phone and listen to what we were talking about because it was party line. Anyone here? And yeah, some of you know, right? So there was no such thing as, like, hiding things on your phone. Like, that wasn't an option for us. And all that, this is so fascinating to me. And then my oldest son comes to me, and he's like, "Dad, I'm going to hang out with my friends." And it's like almost midnight, right? And so he was really excited about hanging out with friends, and none of them were actually in the home, but still they were going to hang out, and it wasn't on his phone, it was in his video games, right? So he's connecting with 4 of his buddies to play Siege, his video game. And not only are they hanging out with four of their buddies from around the city, because that's their friends, but they're hanging out with multiple other people from literally around the globe. And all of a sudden you're like, okay, this is an incredibly different experience that we're engaging in. And then just, you know, something funny on the back end. So here's my oldest son, who's now hanging out with friends around the globe at midnight. And then for Christmas, what does he want for Christmas? Yeah, this really new awesome technology called a record player. So for Christmas, he bought him a record player. And I was so depressed, because when I grew up, you know, the only place that we could get music, well, in our home anyways, was at the Christian bookstore. Do you remember those days?
Yeah.
And so the best that we were getting were Christian LPs. And I thought, this would be so awesome to introduce him to one of my, like, Larry Norman Christian LPs. Unfortunately, I didn't take him. I'm considering blowing his mind for next Christmas and getting him an 8-track player. I think that would be wonderful. This is just a new, you know, this is the new world that we're in. And for me, you know, keeping up is difficult. And then I started thinking about this reality. You know that the speed of information that's coming at us right now, right, with the technologies, that speed, how overwhelming it feels? Do you realize that this moment right here is probably the slowest that we will ever experience, and the least amount of information we will ever experience coming at us in this moment? Like it's just going to pick up speed, right? And so then we're going, okay, Lord, what do we do? How do we respond in a way that, you know, not even just healthy for a kid, but healthy for us? Like, how do we respond in a way that's redemptive in our own lives and the lives of the kids that have been placed in our care? So as I've been wrestling with this, I have three anchor points that I kind of keep coming back to all the time. And let me quickly start with that. The first, and I would call them life preservers, the first life preserver that I keep coming back to is this first reality that I am not in control, but my God is, okay? And if I could just say this, that idea of being in control is not real. Like, we're actually not in control. If I could just be honest and clear on this, like, you're not in control. You think you are, you want to be, and you might try, but ultimately you're not. This became really aware of me a few years ago. My son he'd been hanging out with some buddies, and word came back to us that as friends they were talking, and Peyton had said to his buddy, "Hey, my dad has told me that there's certain things that I have to work out just between God and I, and I don't need to talk with my dad about that." And somehow that had got to parents and came back to me without acknowledging what the issue was. I thought, that's interesting. That makes me nervous. And so then I had this moment with Peyton, and he was about, I think, 13 at the time. I said, "Hey, son, I just heard that this conversation took place." And I said, "Son, I think that's great. Like, I do think there are things that you need to work out between you and God. But I just want you to know, son, that if there's anything you'd like to talk about, you can talk with me. Like, I'm good." He said, goes quiet. And then he goes, "Dad, I'm really scared." I said, "Okay, so, you know, why don't you tell me about that?" And finally, after a little bit of prodding, he goes, "Dad, I looked at porn a while ago." And I said, "Okay." And I just entered into a bit of a conversation with him and just said, "Son, I love you so much. You're okay." And then after we kind of processed through a few of those things, one of the things our ministry does is we deal with the issue of porn. We just put together a curriculum to help youth leaders walk with a child if they disclose on the issue of porn over a long period of time. I just said to him, I said, "Son, can you tell me why you were scared to talk to Dad? Like, you know, I love you and I care for you." And he goes, "Dad, you talk about porn all the time, and I just didn't know how you'd respond to me." And it was just kind of this moment of realization where, like I think I kind of get this topic fairly well. I think I know how to journey with kids fairly well. But in all honesty, like, I don't know. Like, so much is happening that I'm not aware of. And even over the last year, my son has begun to tell me about things that he did with his buddies when I thought I was so in control. Like, I had the internet on lockdown. We had them at our home. We put stuff in public places so that we could observe it. And I just realized, you know what, I'm not nearly in as much control as I think I am. And in those moments, I have to fall back and go, "Okay, but I believe you are God." I have to believe that God is, right? And I have to believe that there's not a single thing beyond God's redemptive hand. Does that make sense? That he actually has the ability to redeem all things, and there's nothing that my child can engage him that ultimately places him in the position of damaged goods that can't experience healing. And so I have to at some point rest and trust in that reality. It's like, okay, God, I'm not in control, but you are. That doesn't mean I shouldn't be responsible. or steward well. But that's reality. Number two is realizing that God is for us, that He's for me. And I love what he says in Romans 8:31-32. He says, "What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things?" And I love the logic here that Paul says, hey, listen, God didn't spare his own son. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is as big as it gets. There's nothing more significant that God could do for us than give us his son. So in light of that reality, don't you think he'll give us whatever else we need to do what he's asking us to do, since it like is infinitely small in comparison to his son? And I'm with you. I'm for you. And I just find that I'm having to consistently recreate my lens of reality. That this is reality. And that when I get this lens created for myself, that God is in control and that God is for me, then that can start to change how I can function and interact with my children and the culture that we find ourselves in, right? So that changes it. And then finally, number three, God has actually called us. That to this time. And in his prayer, he speaks to the reality that he doesn't want us out of the world, but he's actually called us into this world. Do you ever long for the good old days? Right? Okay. Let me kind of burst the bubble. The good old days never actually existed. Ever since Genesis chapter 3, we've experienced brokenness in our world. Does that make sense? And I think when we look back, they seem like simpler days. I understand that. But the reality is that brokenness has existed since Genesis chapter 3. The good old days don't exist, but these days do, and God has called us to these days. So if he's called us here, then, you know, so often we love to isolate and run away, but he's actually calling us to engage and to be present, to be a redemptive presence. And even more than that, he's actually called our kids to a time such as this. So when I think about technologies, like I go, okay, I'm a digital immigrant, right? Like I this wasn't always my world. I remember when we first had computers in our school when I was in like grade 6, and I remember when they first brought in the Commodore C64, and we could load up ExciteBike for like 20 minutes and then play for 5 minutes during noon hour. Like, I thought that was so cool, right? Like, so this was just, you know, I'm an immigrant, but our kids are digital natives. This is the world they know. This is what they know. And that just makes me think, okay, God, then somehow you will place in them visions and strategies and ways of living redemptively in this culture and bringing redemption to this culture, bringing your kingdom way to this culture now. And we're going to have, I think, this wonderful opportunity to watch God do things through our kids that we would never dream or imagine, because in many ways it's actually their world, not ours to some degree, right? And so we get to help journey with them and allow God to work through us as we care for them and see him develop their character. But God has a missional plan for our kids, and he's called them to a time such as this. Okay, so this begins to give me a little bit of hope, and it helps me relax my grip a little bit and just go, okay, Father, I need you to work and work in me and work through me. Okay, so that's kind of foundations for me. Let me dive in here as we go. By the way, as we talk through, if you have any questions, put up your hand. We can have that conversation. If you disagree with something, great. Put up your hand, disagree. I think that'd be a wonderful learning experience for us all also. And so we just want to try to create a little bit of that environment. Or I want to allow you to enter in such a way. What in the world is going on? Let me give you a few kind of ideas in terms of what's happening within our current cultural reality. Common Sense Media puts out research about every 5 years or so in terms of the engagement of young people in digital medias. And it's the last one they just put out 2 years ago, so it's already old, completely outdated. But here's what they said. On any given day, American teenagers, 13 to 18-year-olds, average about 9 hours of entertainment media use. This is excluding time spent at school or for homework per day. Tweens, 8 to 12-year-olds, use an average of about 6 hours worth of entertainment media daily. Now, this might not be linear in nature, so it could be overlapping. So I might spend, you know, an hour texting while I'm also spending an hour, you know, watching my favorite TV show online, right? So it's not necessarily just linear in that sense. Grade 12 students, and this comes from a study in the States they do every 2 years. They survey about 40,000 students called Monitoring the Future Study. And this one just went out a year ago, said that grade 12 students are spending about 2.25 hours per day texting, 2 hours per day on the internet, and 1.5 hours per day electronic gaming. So you'll notice that comes to around 6 hours. And then if you think about the amount of time spent in front of TV, which we wouldn't consider like kind of new digital media opportunity. That's all digital media reality. That you know, you see how it starts to add itself up. 0.5 hours per day on video chat. Grade 8 students, and they just started researching grade 8 students, which is going to be fascinating for them to say, okay, here's what they were engaging in grade 8. Now 4 years later, how are they doing? It's not much different. 1.5 hours per day texting, 1.5 hours per day on the internet, 1.5 hours per day electronic gaming, and 0.5 hours per day on video chat. So my son comes to me the other day, and he goes, hey Dad, you know how you're always on me for spending time in front of screens? I go, yeah. He goes, well, me and my friends are talking, and we think our parents are on the screens just as much or more than us. And I was like, you know, go to your room. So, and then, and then after that, I started thinking you might have a point. So now we're actually trying to start tracking our amount of times that we spend, in particular on our phone and our screens in general. And there's some really cool apps that you can get that can help you track what's taking, you know, how much time you're spending there. And we're just going, okay, let's compare this. Now, I said to him, I said, son, the reason that Dad presses into you about your screen time is because I love you and I want what's best for you. Is that why you're pressing into mine? He's not so sure that's the case. I think we're working through that. That's all right. Doing homework, 50% use social media, 51% watch TV, 60% text, 76% listen to music. So they're often multitasking. By the way, one of the great dangers that we're wrestling with right now is the idea of multitasking is a misnomer. It actually doesn't exist. Our brains don't have the ability to focus in on more than one task at one time in general. What we end up doing is we start doing what the experts would call rapid toggling. And so we're actually teaching our brain to jump from one task to the other very quickly. One of our concerns is that, of course, the brain is malleable, correct? And so we're probably hindering their ability to take a logical thought and process it over a longer period of time, right? And we see that in terms of attention spans and the ability to focus over a longer period of time. My son thinks he's done a lot of homework if he spends 10 to 15 minutes working on a subject right now. And he's in grade 11. So, you know, that one of our concerns is how we're processing that with our kids. 98%, this is kids age 8 and under. So for the first time this past year, Common Sense Media started studying little children. And here's what they found. 98% of kids age 8 and under come from a home with a mobile device, up from 75% in 2013 and 52% in 2011. So, of course, we see that rising. Kids age 8 and under spend an average of 2 hours and 19 minutes a day with screen media. 35% of all screen time is mobile. So more and more we'll see them move into their screens on mobile devices, which, you know, of course, one of the concerns is that you used to have to go to get media content. Now media content is in your pocket. And marketers are geniuses at figuring out ways to get into the minds of the kids that have, you know, these devices in their care. And so there's this new way of pursuing that's happening. This has actually changed how we look at dealing with the issue of pornography, right? So it used to be if someone had a significant issue of pornography, they probably had to work pretty hard to get to it. Right, like they had to work through maybe another adult behind a counter, buy a weird magazine, or visit their friends or weird uncle that something got stuck underneath his mattress, whatever. Like you had to work to get to it, chance of being caught. Now porn works to get to you, and so we really look at it more as a victimization in many ways, and it's kind of changing the way that we journey with people. There's so much shame associated with it, and so we fight hard to remove shame, which allows openness and grace to begin to do transforming work. So there's just a lot that's kind of shifting in some of those areas. Kids age 8 and under spend 48 minutes per day on mobile devices, 8 and under, up from 15 minutes in 2013 and 5 minutes in 2011. According to Time magazine, 68% of mobile phone users take their devices to bed with them. How many of us have our device within arm's reach at night? I know, me too. I've just started thinking this isn't super helpful for me, so I'm thinking of going to this new thing called an analog clock. We'll see if that works. 20% check their phones every 10 minutes. 1/3 report feeling anxious when briefly separated from their mobile. Okay, come on. How many, right? I mean, I've had to turn mine off right now, and I cannot wait for the break when I can find out who's texting me. It's going to be wonderful. Video games is fascinating. We've been spending more time working through video games. I'm just going to touch real quick. So interesting. In fact, it's probably the fastest growing platform of entertainment media right now. Global revenues for video games is at about $101.62 billion, $20 billion higher than the music industry. We used to say to our kids, you know, like, video games aren't going to be helpful for you. You need to work hard so you can go to a good university. Or you could just play video games. Robert Morris University in Chicago handed out over $500,000 in athletic scholarships to gamers. That was a few years ago. It is estimated that the average person will spend 10,000 hours gaming by the age of 21. So we're living like, we would call this kind of a quantum cultural shift right now. So think about 20 years ago, those 10,000 hours somehow went into like real-time experience, and now it's in the virtual world. What difference will that make for us? Like, and we're not really sure, right? Because these are kind of some of the new experiences that are taking place. Competitive video gaming, more commonly known as esports, drew 258 million unique viewers globally last year. My son just informed me that, so we're having to set new boundaries around my boy. So we don't allow our boys to, generally speaking, play video games during the week. They get a few. They get to play on the weekend. And by the way, when it comes to putting boundaries on your kids, especially in video games, remember that you're never just creating a boundary around playing a game. You're creating a boundary around their communal experience. Does that make sense? So my kid's biggest problem is not when we put boundaries that they don't get to play games, it's that he's left out of his friendship circle. So video games, they carry a lot of social collateral. And so we just have to be really aware. Sometimes, you know, when I take something like a game away from my son and his reaction is strong, it's not that he's reacting to the game, it's that he's reacting to the loss of a social interaction. And that can be very significant for him. So you just become aware of that. But 2 weeks ago, the reason I say that is not only are we putting boundaries around his playing, but what he's watching. 2 weeks ago, the new eSport league around the Siege video game just had their first game of the week. And I think he told me they had 2 million viewers online watching them stream the game, 4 people playing against each other. The National Football League said that 204 million unique viewers tuned into the NFL regular season in the U.S. So video games are drawing more viewers, not players, viewers, than the NFL. Within the next 2 years, I think you will be seeing a full NFL eSport league where each team is building their own a video game team, and they'll play competitively against one another. And the NBA is already going there. I think they have 5 NBA teams have an eSport team as well, and they're already working in that kind of area. So it's just fascinating how this whole new world is just moving. When it comes to porn, and of course, you know, porn is a big issue that we struggle with when it comes to our online realities. There's a couple of kind of trends out right now that I think it's good for us just to acknowledge. Number one, it's not just a male issue. And so, you know, the stats, by the way, stats on pornography are historically quite conservative. I'm always a little nervous when it comes to stats because people are generally trying to push an agenda when they create a stat and so they frame it or shape it. When it comes to porn, interestingly, most of the stats we see are quite conservative in nature for two reasons. One, they're generally old. So many of the stats we work with are pre-2005, before the smartphone really took hold of our cultural reality. That changed the game. And also because porn is a shame-based experience, so very rarely do people actually disclose what's actually happening in their life, right? And in fact, when we work with kids struggling with porn, what we hear from them in terms of their sharing with us their story at the beginning, we just kind of assume that that's not the whole picture. And as relational trust grows, hopefully over time that picture will begin to expand. But it's not just a male issue. So the stats would say that about 30% to 40% of females are actively pursuing porn like once a month or so. Anecdotally, when I'm speaking to a group of senior high students, I just assume that as many females as males have been exposed to pornography right now. One of the implications for us when we work with youth workers is most times when we speak on porn, either it's a male speaking on it or we speak to it as if it's a male issue. Does that make sense? And so here's the problem with that. It's shame-based, remember, right? Kids don't want to disclose. My son comes to me the other day and we're in the car. He goes, Dad, we just had someone at our school talk on porn. I said, okay, son, tell me about that. He goes, well, she said that if we look at porn, we're perverts. Our marriages will be wrecked. We hate women. And we're just kind of disgusting people. I said, oh, okay. He goes, Dad, if that's true, yeah. If me and my friends ever look at porn, yeah, we will never tell anyone. And so you see how when we create environments of shame dealing with the issue, we end up exacerbating the issue. So what happens, you know, with our young females, when we speak at it as if it's just a male issue, we have females in the audience that are going, oh man, if that's just a male issue, I'm a female, I'm struggling with porn, I must be really screwed up, there's no hope for me, and there's no way I'm telling anyone what I'm wrestling with. So So we're just trying to be a little bit more aware how we deal with that. First encounters seem to be happening earlier and earlier. Again, I was just talking with a Youth for Christ worker yesterday. They would say the latest researcher says that average age of first exposure is around 7. I was asked to speak about porn at a Mennonite colony in Belize because their 10 and 11-year-olds were passing on their hardcore porn stash to their 11 and 12-year-olds to their 9 and 10-year-olds. So it's younger and younger in that sense. By the way, here's one of the things that means for us. We have to fight to have age-appropriate, situational-appropriate conversations around healthy relationships at earlier ages than we originally thought. And here's why, I think, because we want to be the ones that create the lens through which they interpret the sexual messages that come their way. Does that make sense? And if porn gets to them first, and that becomes the founder of the lens. So we just have to fight to kind of wrestle with that. I'm going to give you a thought here on this one real quick. By the way, speakers often sound like they live the perfect life and have all the perfect answers. Essentially, if you hear my stories, I'm telling you about 15 minutes worth of my whole life. Does that make sense? Trust me, everything else is like mostly fail and trying to learn. But we had this one moment. I remember Peyton was, and maybe this would be helpful. We were asked to babysit friends of ours, their kids. They had three boys, Jackson, who was 5, same age as Peyton at that time, Luke, who was 7, and Drew, who was 9, and Cole was 3. So they gave us their vehicle to drive the kids around. They had a Cadillac Escalade, which was like so cool for a youth pastor to drive. And I remember when I got in the Cadillac, we turned it on, and they had Sirius satellite radio. At that time, the number one song was Justin Timberlake's song, Sexy Back. And so immediately, I turn it, because we have all these little kids in it. And Drew, the oldest kid, goes, hey, what'd you turn that off for? And I said, well, I don't think that's going to be the song we listen to. And it's like, well, that's my favorite song. And so I'm like, finding the Disney Channel, why don't we try this song? You know? So I introduced him to Miley Cyrus, which ended up being a bit of a mistake. Anyways, we tried it. So then the next day I come home, and Paige walks up and he goes, hey, Dad, you know what my favorite song is? I'm like, what? He goes, Sexy Back. And so again, I'm like, I just didn't know how to respond, right? So I was like, you know, go play. And then I thought, that's kind of what my dad did to me growing up. So I thought, here's one of these moments to have an age-appropriate, situational-appropriate conversation, right? So I followed him downstairs, and I called him over, and I just said, hey, son, okay, I just want to talk to you for a second. So he comes over, and he goes, okay. I said, son, do you know why I don't think Sexy Back should be your favorite song? And he's like, no. I said, okay, well, do you know what sex is? And he's like, nope. I'm like, conversation done. Okay, we'll talk to you later. So we just do that. I said, well, sex, and this was really important to me, right? Because now we're having a first-time conversation. So I said to him, I said, son, sex is a really good gift that God gives for a mom and dad to enjoy together. Now that phrase good was important, right? Because this is about being theologically correct as well. I don't know about you. When I grew up, I would hear speakers talk on the issue, and I know they didn't mean it. But what I would hear is them saying, sex is bad, sex is evil, sex is terrible. So save it for your spouse. And I was like, ah. I said, sex is a really good gift that God gives for mom and dad to do together. And when people who aren't mom and dad do sex stuff, it ends up hurting them, and it makes God sad because he has something better for us. And so I said, the reason why I don't think Sexy Back should be your favorite song is because it kind of tells people who aren't moms and dads to do sex stuff together, which will end up hurting them and make God sad. And so he's quiet for a second, and he goes, hey, Dad. I go, yeah, son. He goes, you should tell Drew's mom that. I'm like, she'll figure it out. No, we're good. This is such a great opportunity to start those conversations. Number 3, porn is everywhere. Hardcore porn is becoming popular porn. This concerns me a lot. One of the things I say to parents that I think would be really great is at least like once a month, if you could like go on muchmusic.ca or mtv.ca and either A, you know, read the lyrics of kind of the top 10 latest songs or watch the videos, I think would be really helpful because it would give you a window into kind of the culture shapers and the way that some of our popular culture shapers are trying to educate our children and could create opportunity to have conversation at some time in appropriate ways. So, you know, one of the things we do with our boys is when a song comes on, and I'm a little bit concerned about the message behind the song, I'll just go, hey, let's check this song out online. We'll read the lyrics together. And then we'll just go, hey, what do you think about how these people are interacting in the song? Do you think that's good? Do you think that's something that's healthy as human beings to act that way? Do you think this is something that would please please God and make him happy? Eh. Okay, how do you think God would have us interact with each other? You know, so we're always just, we're trying to become critical. My goal is to teach them to be critical thinkers. Like, that would be kind of a big win for me. As long as I'm not too critical and start critiquing my messages, then I prefer that to stop. It's amazing how you get the kickback. So it's happening, right? So, and just, you know, one of my concerns is like that, you know, porn is proliferating, but it's the type of porn that's being sold that concerns me a lot, okay? And then finally, cultural options for sex, sexual orientation, and gender continue to grow. So our culture is giving more and more options around the idea of, you know, gender, male, female, plus a million other options, and those sorts of things. And so these are just some of the elements that are starting to concern me more and more when it comes to this issue in particular. Okay, here's what I want to do. I'm going to just take a couple of minutes, and with the people around you, I just want you to have a quick conversation and answer the question, what part of our kids' digital world kind of fascinates, interests, or concerns you the most, and why? And then after about like 2 minutes, so discipline yourself to allow a couple others to talk as well, I'll just say, hey, what have you heard that's come out of the conversation? Does that make sense? And that can just help us get a sense of where we're all kind of thinking. Okay, so go ahead, take about 2 minutes with the people around you and have that conversation.
The interesting around the issue of Snapchat, so first of all, when Snapchat was created, the original design was around explicit messages that could disappear. And then, you know, that started to go south for them in terms of marketing, so they remarketed themselves to be storytellers for kids to share stories. Now, there is a really, you know, I'm just reading a book, and I'm going to reference it a number of times, called iGen by a lady named Jean Twenge, and she's a sociologist or psychologist from San Diego State University, does a lot of work and research in this generation and the effects of social media on kids. She would actually recommend, in this sense, apps that don't hold content long-term for kids, mostly because, especially when it's negative messaging, kids can never get away from it, and at least in this kind of an environment, the story can kind of come to an end a little bit. So it's just trying to make the best of the worlds that we have. But I agree with you, that's concerning and somewhat scary. Now, when I'm talking to students in general, like, so if they see me not as kind of an authority figure, they'll share that explicit messaging is happening less on Snapchat and actually more on some other platforms, like even Instagram and just texting in general. So it is interesting how, like, for us, you know, even in youth ministries, they'll say to me, hey, Sid, should we use Snapchat as a way of messaging at our conferences? Is that promoting an app that's actually dangerous for our kids? And I would just say that, like, the way that we used to understand Snapchat and the way that many of our kids understand Snapchat are actually two different experiences to some degree. But it concerns me as a parent because I'm not in control.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then I remember, oh, my kids actually have this crazy ability to create more than one account on different platforms.
Exactly, yes.
Right? And so I probably don't actually completely know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, anyway. So there, you know, so there's some back and forth. That's a fair concern. Thank you. Okay. Other guests, go ahead. And how we've created a fear-based culture in many ways. I'm going to show you a few stats in just a second. Time magazine put it out the other day. The level of anxiety and fear amongst adolescents has gone up by like 60% over like the last 5 to 8 years. And here's something that's really fascinating that's happening. And one of my concerns is the disengagement from reality. So here's something really interesting that's happening with iGens right now, especially high school students. So our iGens, what they're saying, are actually they're engaging in sex less and at a later time in their adolescent journey than what we've seen before. So that's a good thing. They're drinking less. They're doing less drugs. Okay, so these are all good things. They're also getting their driver's license later. They're actually taking on a job later and doing less hours on a job than we used to see. They're doing less schoolwork, which is also fascinating. And so then we go, okay, where are they putting their time? Well, 6 hours a day into new media platforms. Okay, so that's what's happening. But what's driving these activities, most of it is fear. And so they're coming to us and saying, well, you've told us over and over again, if we have sex, you know, early, it'll create a bond that's going to wreck my life. And so they're afraid. You know, I don't want to drive, because what if I get an accident? I'll let you drive. You're doing it for me anyway, so they're afraid. I'm not going to, you know, so they've heard all these messages, but it's actually created this culture of fear. So what's happening, in many ways, the motivation behind the activities are things that are legal. I'm not sure that's healthy long term. And here's what's really interesting is this new phenomenon called the extension of adolescence. So if you took a look at Erickson's model
of identity formation, what we used to kind of assume was that adolescence was a really egocentric experience, and then you began to understand your identity based on your community, and then you could become an active contributor to society. We said that happened around like 18. Now we would say that extends to 25 to 29 kind of idea. And a lot of it deals with this culture of fear that's keeping them from wanting to step into experiences of responsibility. And so there's some really fascinating kind of pieces that are going along with this. Yeah, and we drive it. Like, yeah, anyways, that's a great point. Thank you. And just the way even our news is framing a world that's really dangerous and scary. And yet there's many great things that are happening as well. And again, we have to help create the lens that we see the world not through the newscast, but through the reality that Scripture portrays of who God is and how we should enter in. Okay, good. Okay, let me quickly go through concerns, which are concerns that we have, and then I want to just end by going through some ways I think we should respond. Okay. Number one, of course, we're concerned about access to inappropriate content. That should concern us. And we continue to fight to guard and protect against that. The other thing that we really need to do is start teaching our kids how to respond when inappropriate content comes their way. Does that make sense? And so, you know, we used to do this with our boys. We started fairly early on. We just said, hey, boys, at some point you're going to be online or at a friend's place and a naked picture is going to come up. Here's how we respond in our home when that happens. And so we just gave them two or three easy steps to do that. And then, you know, in appropriate moments, we had the opportunity to say, here's what's going to be happening in you. Like, you'll have this interesting feeling that will probably take place. And part of that's really good. God's created you that way. So we just kind of walk through some of that type of conversation with them to help equip and prepare them to respond well when the moments came their way. So you know, the question is no longer will they be exposed, but will they have some tools to know how to respond when they're exposed. And even when they would go with their friends, we started giving them ways that if they found themselves in a situation that they were uncomfortable with, we would just give them different cues and things. So you can text Dad and say this, and then I'll text you back and say, hey, I'm coming to get you. Something came up at home. You know what I mean? And so we'd also guard them from some of the social pressure that went along with the decisions that they were making. So we were always just kind of help our kids journey through that. Number two, engagement in inappropriate posting. You know, one of the things we don't talk a lot about is how things like Facebook and Instagram actually affirm and develop narcissism in us, right? So we post, and the reason we post is to get likes so that we feel validated in who we are as the people who are posting. So we started talking with our kids at a really young age again of why are you posting what you're posting? And we just talk around it, you know, like, are you posting in order to get people to celebrate you? Is this a way of celebrating your friends or celebrating something good together? And of course, they couldn't totally get it, you know, right? Like, they're like, Dad, you're weird. I'm just putting stuff online. But I'm hoping that by having the conversation, when their formal operational thought begins to develop, they'll be able to reflect back and there'll be some foundations in place that help them make good decisions. So we're always just trying to enter that conversation. Disengagement from life beyond the screen. So we already spoke about that. I just had a conversation with my son today. And he didn't make the basketball team this year. And it like broke him because it was really his primary social experience that he had. And so he said to me, Dad, I really want to make the basketball team next year. I'm going to work at it. And now he's really heavy into gaming again. We're really battling this battle. So I talked to him on the phone today and I said, hey, son, you know, we said there's a couple of things you need to do physically, like exercise-wise, in order to be able to accomplish something you want. And I said, there's no guarantee if you do this exercise that you're going to make the team. I'm not telling you that at all, son. But I do know that by doing exercise, it's going to be really healthy for you no matter what happens with your team. And so I said, son, we need to start getting more active. By the way, I was just talking with two doctor friends of mine. And here's what they're saying right now. 150 minutes of activity per week, in particular for adults, but exercise activity per week is a tipping point for mental health. So they're finding that 150 minutes of activity per week is a game changer when it comes to mental health, even better than some of the drugs that we're administering on this kind of baseline journey towards happiness and health. And part of it is when you move, the dopamine and the right chemicals get moving through your body, changes your disposition. Correct? We actually know this. I mean, it takes now at this age about 2 months of exercise to actually feel good after exercise, right? Like, up to that point, it's just pain. But it certainly changes the way that we see our world. In fact, if we work with kids who are struggling with depression or even anxieties, we do the stupid thing called read, write, and run. And so we go, hey, we want you to read, get truth in your mind. So let's start reading, especially scripture in particular. And then let's get the negative messaging out. So what's the music? You know, we go through the playlist. What are you listening to? Is that affirming the negative messages you're hearing, or is it actually giving you hope? Right is like be honest. So we need you to honestly express your thoughts, in particular through prayer. So we talk about journaling. And then run is just a word of being active. And we just say whatever it takes to get outside, breathe fresh air, see creation, and move your body. And we're finding that to be really helpful in a movement towards mental health. Okay, not everything, and the situations are complex, but these are helpful things that we start working on. I think one of the great things that we can do with our kids is figure out activities as families that we can engage in. We live in Kelowna, and so we just started buying like passes as a family to the ski hill. And I know it's expensive, but we see it as an investment in the physical health of our children and in the relational health of our family. So it's a great shared experience for us. We're thankful for that. Number four, I talked about the reinforcement of narcissistic tendencies. I'm going to jump right through that. Number five, impaired neurological development. And so there is some correlation between the amount of time spent on screens and the slowing down of development of the frontal lobe of the brain, which controls your ability to be sympathetic, empathetic, and think logically over a longer period of time. So, you know, the brain is a powerful thing, and it does develop itself. We're just, you know, we're saying it seems to be taking longer to reach full maturation. And we would suggest that happens around the age of 25. Now, if you ask kids to start functioning responsibly and other-centered earlier, then we can start seeing that shift again a little bit. So that's, we're thankful for that. And then this one is an epidemic rise in anxiety and mental health issues. So here's what Time said to us. From 2010 to 2016, adolescents who experienced at least one major depressive episode increased by 60%. And this correlated really strongly with the amount of time spent in social media in particular, and screens as well. A recent study found that kids who spent 3 hours or more a day on smartphones were 34% more likely to experience at least one suicide-related outcome, which would be like, I have no hope for tomorrow, I put a plan together to end my life, I have attempted something that's self-injurious in nature, than kids who use them 2 hours a day or less. By the way, here's what the research also said. There seemed to be no change in the happiness index up to 2 hours, but after that we started seeing a change in mental health and emotional experience. Among kids who use electronic devices 5 or more hours a day, 48% had at least one suicide-related outcome. And so these are game changers. Six possible contributing factors. So we kind of go, why do the screens contribute this way? And we don't know for sure, but here's some of the things we're thinking. Number one, we're creating an unrealistic expectation of reality. So people are posting things about their lives, and they're mitigating those things in such a way that don't actually reflect reality, but they create this expectation in kids that my life doesn't measure up. You know, we're doing a new research project across Canada right now of the transition from high school to post-secondary life. So we've just finished interviewing young adults right across the country. And there's this interesting change that we seem to see happening. For millennials, it used to be that there was this great fear of failure economically that seemed to be kind of freezing them in their journey towards adulthood. Does that make sense? Now the great fear is not necessarily economic failure. The great fear is actually that they'll end up getting a job that will be mundane in nature, and they won't be able to live the exciting life however they define that. And so part of what we're trying to do even now with our kids is redefine what is a life well lived. Part of that is simply providing for your family and others. Like, that's a wonderful life well lived. Great job. So it was really fascinating how that's working. Vulnerability to unhealthy relationships. So when I talk to kids, most of them see that their online relationships are fairly healthy. Very few talk about bullying, but those who talk about bullying do so in ways that we've never heard before, because the bullying never ends and it grows in scope. And so that's deeply concerning to us. It used to be that you would be bullied at school. I remember when I was, but I could come home to a safe family and that bullying didn't follow me. And now it just carries on in your pocket and probably grows. That makes sense. Number three, the fear of missing out, FOMO. So everyone else is doing something awesome together and I'm not invited. My youngest son, Cole, this past year got rid of all of his social media accounts because some basketball player said he didn't want to care what other people thought of him. And so he just got rid of it. I'm thinking of actually creating an online persona of a basketball player that just keeps shooting my values at my son and seeing if he'll respond well to that. We'll see if that works. But what happened this summer, which was great, is he didn't know what his buddies were doing, so he was able to be present in the moments that we found ourselves together, right? And so he just enjoyed his time, and then they shared stories when they got back to school. Loss of time spent in face-to-face relationships. So what we're seeing is the more time spent online, the happiness index, unhappiness grows, the more time spent face-to-face, happiness grows. And we don't even know why. What's the difference between enjoying each other through the mediums, like through the screens, but it's different than face-to-face. And it's just a reality that we're seeing. Number five, less time being physically active. And number six, loss of quality sleep. So, you know, part of that is when you see blue screens, it tells the brain that it's daytime. We're not sure why that is, but it seems to, so it's harder for the brain to shut down. Conversations never end, so kids are never let out of a conversation. They always want to know what's happening. And then do you know how hard it is, like when relational drama is happening, and you're like, you know how hard it is to go to sleep in those seasons when things aren't settled relationally? So what happens when that relational drama carries on your phone for half the night right beside you? How difficult is that to calm your brain, right? I really, really believe strongly in removing our digital devices from our kids when they go to bed and getting them out of the room. Like I think that would be one of the great gifts that we could give to our children. So these are just some of those contributing factors. So how should we respond then in light of that? Let me give you just a few thoughts real quick,
and then we'll turn to conversation. Number one, we need to think about technology in a Christian way.
And what I mean by that is technology in and of itself is not evil. God designed us to be stewards of creation using technology to do so. Whether that technology is a shovel or a tractor or a computer, God is calling us to use technologies to steward creation. And so that's a great thing. However, like ourselves, creation is broken because of the fall. And so it tends to lean towards sinful and destructive realities. But God can redeem because of Christ's work on the cross, and through those who have been redeemed, we can use technologies in redemptive ways. Okay, so I just think we have to, let's not be afraid of it. Let's ask ourselves questions like, how is this technology affecting me? Is it positive or negative? What am I looking to get out of it? And then how can I use it in redemptive ways, or how can I play a redemptive role in our reality? Number two, we should evaluate our own personal use of technology. You know, the best way that our kids are learned is by what they observe in our personal journeys, right? And so Peyton was right. I evaluate my son's use of technology, but am I actually evaluating my own use of technology? Hey, one of the things that we do in our family, which is just kind of different, is our kids are actually on the same Netflix account as we are. And I'm finding what that does when I travel is it creates a really significant accountable relationship with my family. Because what I watch, my kid will know what I watch because it'll actually show up on the account. Now that's created some interesting things. Like I'll go to my boys and I'll go, hey boys, if you see a movie that dad's watched and it's not finished, don't hit resume on it. Because I probably watched it to something that's not appropriate and turned it off. He goes, we know, Dad. And they're like, maybe next time you could fast forward it to something that's not so inappropriate. So if we accidentally click on it, we're not in the moment that you shut it down at. So we're trying to work through that. And then, you know, we have honest conversations, right? Like sometimes they go, Dad, you watch that? Can we watch that? And I'll go either, hey, you know what? That was a movie I don't think I should have watched. And I'll just be honest with them, boys, that wasn't helpful. It wasn't healthy. I'm sorry. I wouldn't go there. But the other thing I might say is that's a good movie, but I don't think it's appropriate for you right now. When you're older, love you to watch it, but there's just some things that I think would be hard to process, not helpful for you. Or, yeah, let's watch that together again. I think that would be great. Okay, so we're just having conversations. All right, here's a little takeaway. When it comes to media, especially when our boys were younger, we created three categories that we would talk about. We would talk about popcorn, protein, and poison. So some art was popcorn. It was like candy. You know, fine. It's neither really good or bad. Like if you eat too much, it'll kind of make you sick, like One Direction. But so you could just be careful with that. And then some of it is like poison. It's just bad for you, so we're not going to go there. But we really want to try to find stuff that's like protein. It's really healthy for us. And so let's spend time there. So sometimes we would just go to our boys, hey, we spent a lot of time on popcorn lately. Let's try to dive into some protein for a while, right? And just help create some categories that were helpful for us. Three, create and recreate boundaries for your family. So create the boundaries, and you'll blow them, like we do all the time. Then recreate them again. And sometimes I would say to my boys, Dad, why do you say I can't play that game? And I'd go, son, I don't even know. But today, this is the boundary we're going to make, because I'm not sure. Maybe it'll change tomorrow. Bear with me. I'm just doing my best, okay? And so we'd say that, and we'd fight, and we'd process it. Number four, delay smartphone and social media use. I really believe this. Please delay it, if you can. One of the things we're talking about right now is, you know, grade 7, 8, 9 are really socially fragile stage of the journey for kids. And if you can help them make it through that time without total social breakdown, that's a win. And so we're trying to keep, you know, our kids as much away from smartphones through that stage as possible. And we just find that on the other side, they're a little bit more mature to be able to handle some of the relational realities that go along with it. So delay. I think delaying boundaries are really helpful. Shoot, get a flip phone if you need to. They might think it's cool anyways, kind of like a record player. Ooh, this is cool technology. And they can't text nearly as much because you have to hit the button 3 times as much to get a letter, right? So that might be fun. Number five, where appropriate, engage with your kids in their digital world. So when you can, play with them, journey with them, where it's right and okay. Our sons, by the way, allow us to follow their Instagram account that we know of. But the boundaries they set is that we can't comment on any of their friends' postings, or theirs actually either. So we're out on that stuff. However, we said if their friends start following us, then we're gonna comment on it anyways, because now they're our friends. They're like, you're a loser, stop it. So we have to. Yeah. I think what I would do, I mean, you're always looking for the moment where not only do you have a chance to speak, but they're maybe in a position where they're willing to listen. So rarely is it helpful in the midst of the fight. I used to always think, I have to get you to respond right to me now, so I'm going to battle you until you do it. That, we didn't win. Nobody won. We just had wars. So you know, you're looking for the moments when things are kind of a healthy place. You've had a good shared experience together. And then I might say something like, hey, Peyton, do you know why Dad... Well, you know, we talked about video games the other day. I said, son, do you know why Dad limits your video game use? He goes, no. I said, well, to be honest with you, I'm just not sure what kind of healthy things come out of that for you. Do you know, does that make sense? And what I want is what's best for you, and so I know these things are really healthy. And so that's why Dad's going to limit that. And we'll try to create ways. Like, I know it's hard for you because you're going to miss out on friends. So we'll do everything we can to create ways for you to engage your friends well. But just so you know, son, this is why I'm doing this for you. And I know it's going to be hard for you. Talk to me. We'll fight. We'll change. Our boundaries will shift. But I just need you to know that I'm trying to do something that's for you in this way. So that might be a way I might enter the conversation around those platforms. But here's the other thing I think we have to be aware of. Like, sometimes I'll take away something that removes kind of an opportunity for social engagement for my children. Then I'm asking myself the question, what am I doing to help replace that platform with something that can continue to build the friendship experiences? Because they need that. So I'm trying to look for those kind of ways to do that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no easy answer on this, right? Like, it works maybe sometimes, but trust me, by the next day, we're back at it again. You know, hey, we signed up for parenting. I think one of the reasons why we want to quickly as parents sometimes solve our kids' problems is because their problems become a significant inconvenience for us, isn't it? But actually, this is something that we sign on for. This is what we're called to do. This is who we are. But it is a difficult journey. And then finally, invest in shared experiences and activities. I was talking to my friend Chris. He's a principal at a public school in Lethbridge. And he did his master's in technologies. And he just said to me, he goes, Sid, I do seminars for parents on how to tech-proof their homes, but the minute I do the seminar, it's already out of date. And any kind of proofing that I put in the home, while it can be helpful to kind of guard the journey, every single kid that has technology has already figured out ways around that. So he said to me, he just goes, Sid, you know what I'm teaching the most? I said, what? He goes, I'm teaching... shared experience equals relationship, which allows for communication. So I'm saying doing everything you can to build shared experiences with your kids, which continues to develop the relationship and then allows for opportunities of communication. Now, the other thing we do with adolescents is we try to bring other people on board who are different than us but share our values that our kids will actually listen to in the seasons when they won't listen to us, right? This is where youth ministries are wonderful. One of the things that we started doing in our home was because there are seasons where our kids won't listen to us, but they will listen to their youth leaders. So we just started inviting their youth leaders over for supper and telling them what they need to say to our kids. I just manipulated the process. I don't care. I'm doing whatever I can. You know, I think that's great. The other thing, by the way, that I think is absolutely phenomenal is camping ministries. So camping ministries does a number of things for us. Number one, it allows them to remove themselves from their social media world, but embed themselves in a deeply social context. Does that make sense? And then not only that, but they're physically active, which is great for the chemicals that are working through them. They're involved in missional living, and so they see something significant happen to them as they serve others. They have immediate coaching and mentoring, and this happens over a longer period of time. I think right now, my theory is that the most important part of camping is not so much what happens with campers, but what happens with staff. So if you can find a camp where the leaders are intentional about what they're doing in discipling and developing their staff, you can never invest enough in that type of an environment for the health of your children and the next generation. Absolute game changer in my world. Okay.